from VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Ian Kelly, assistant producer in our current affairs unit and a senior at the University of Wisconsin, majoring in political science and international studies. Our topic, the growing threat of domestic terrorism in the United States and whither the Republican Party. Our guest, Elizabeth Newman, formerly Assistant Secretary for Counterterrorism and Threat Prevention in the Department of Homeland Security. She also served as Senior Advisor and Deputy Chief of Staff for the Department of Homeland Security. She resigned from the Trump administration in April 2020 and became a founding member of the Republican Political Alliance for Integrity and Reform, or REPAIR, and co-director of the Republican Accountability Project. According to its website, the Republican Accountability Project aims to counter the, quote, big lie that former President Trump and his Republican allies are perpetuating that the 2020 election was stolen from Trump. The January 6th violent attack on the U.S. Capitol by radical Trump supporters attempted but ultimately failed to halt the peaceful transfer of power to then-President-elect Joe Biden. Despite the passage of time since that fateful day, which resulted in the destruction of federal property, at least five deaths and scores of injured, Mr. Trump and his supporters, including many Republican lawmakers, continue to promulgate the falsehood that Trump won the election. The Republican Accountability Project aims to counter this lie because, quote, it erodes Americans' faith in the integrity of our electoral system, creates more opportunity for violence from radical actors, and it threatens the very democracy we all cherish, unquote. The Republican Accountability Project is subsumed under the umbrella organization Defending Democracy Together. They say that they are dedicated to defending America's democratic norms, values, and institutions, and fighting for consistent conservative principles like the rule of law, free trade, and expanding legal immigration. We'll talk with Elizabeth Newman about the challenges she faced in the Trump administration, the extent to which the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol may have emboldened the many right-wing white supremacist and anti-government militia groups who participated, and how she and her organization intend to push back against the lies about the 2020 election and hold accountable those who continue to trade in this conspiracy theory. Elizabeth Newman joins us via Microsoft Teams. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my panelist, Ian Kelly.
Thanks, Carol. It's great to be back.
So, Elizabeth, what prompted you to leave the Trump administration back in April 2020? Was there a particular turning point for you?
It's more like a season. It was the El Paso Walmart attack in August of 2019, and we had already been working on domestic terrorism issues. It really raised the awareness among the national security community, which has a lot on their plate. But that attack kind of crystallized that this movement was not just something that was going to go away on its own. It's something that required dedicated focus and attention. And there were a series of meetings and efforts to try to figure out the best way to go after this threat, a lot of policy questions, a lot of how do you take the tools that we've built up over the last 20 years to go after Al-Qaeda and ISIS and appropriately apply them to this threat. And what we found is that while we can make some progress within the existing authorities of the Department of Homeland Security, the White House and the national security officials there were not able to do that much more. And it's still unclear to me why, but as more has come out, it is my sense that senior officials understood that if they had gone to the president and said, sir, we have a problem with violent white supremacy in our country, that he would have deflected. He would have not been interested in doing what we are used to when we face a threat, which is clearly define the threat, prioritize resources to go after that threat, make it clear to the American public that we will not stand for this, right? He was not going to be interested in doing that. So the national security officials tended to encourage DHS, the organization I was with, you guys go do the things that you can do, FBI do what you need to do, but let's not try to raise this up. And I tend to give people the benefit of the doubt, but after 3 years of watching senior officials have to sidestep something that was critically boiling over by this point in 2019, it just became clear that Donald Trump himself was not just ignoring the problem, but in the terrorist manifesto itself, you saw language from his campaign, from his rallies, showing up in this manifesto, talking about a Hispanic invasion. So it was not just that he was ignoring the threat, it was that he was actually adding to the threat. He was encouraging the threat. He was pouring fuel on the fire. So it kind of was a moment where I realized I probably, if I had thought about it sooner, I would have come to this conclusion. Nobody had asked me the question until the fall of 2019, are you going to vote for him again in 2020? And the answer was like, no, of course, I can't vote for him. He's increasing the threat to our country. And that was the moment where it became clear to me I needed to leave. It wasn't appropriate for me to serve as a political appointee when I could not support him as president anymore. And so it took a while to move the pieces around to make sure that the folks in my office were cared for and had appropriate leadership. And I didn't get to leave until the spring of 2020. But it was that time period, that season of trying to develop a response to what had happened in El Paso that really made it clear to me that it was time for me to depart.
And Elizabeth, of course, it's conventional wisdom that it's very important to have leadership at the very top to do what you're doing, fighting domestic terrorism. And of course, it's much more difficult when the Oval Office incumbent doesn't actually acknowledge there's a problem. We read reports that a lot of money was diverted actually from the need to fight the growing threat of domestic terrorism and going toward militant Islamist terrorism, which certainly is a threat, but wasn't as important. But let me ask you, now that you have left and you have been part of this Republican Accountability Project, what other challenges do you face? Are you seeing Republicans continuing to push the lie that the election was somehow stolen and are not to this day acknowledging the actual factors that led to the insurrection and that these are domestic terrorists, white supremacists, neo-Nazi groups, and other anti-government militia groups?
It is a sad and kind of fascinating moment that we find ourselves in where we all watched what happened on January 6th. It was very clear. There were signs and symbols of the people that were there. And now over 400, approaching 500 indictments. Each one of those indictments lays out a ton of social media posts that the person that's been indicted posted themselves, selfies of them at the insurrection, and viewpoints about what they were fighting for. It is so clear that most of them were there to try to overturn the results of the election because they believed that the election had been stolen. What's fascinating is that over 100 days later, we now have a sizable portion of the Republican Party elected officials trying to memory hole January 6th, inserting doubt that what you saw with your eyes didn't actually happen, suggesting that they were false flag operations. And that suggestion started almost immediately. You were seeing suggestions on certain news networks or on Twitter that these are not Trump supporters. This is Antifa. This is a false flag operation. Well, all of that's been debunked by multiple pieces of evidence, hard facts. This is not speculation. People confirming themselves that they are not Antifa, that they were MAGA, they were Trump supporters. We also have, though the percentage is small, about 12 to 13% of the people that have been indicted so far were affiliated with violent extremist organizations like neo-Nazis or the Proud Boys or Oath Keepers. This was a very dangerous mix of people that were inspired towards political violence by Donald Trump and violent extremist actors who perhaps were there because they supported Trump. Perhaps they were there just because they're opportunistic. But anyway, you shake it, what happened on January 6th could have been much worse. And the context, I think, is what is so important. This wasn't just a riot at a random city or state building. This was, and it's not just, oh, it was the U.S. Capitol. It was the day that they were certifying the election results. The intent was to actually overturn the election results or create pressure on Congress so that they would overturn those results. That is undermining the foundation of what our governance is based on, this peaceful transition of power based on our democratic republic's values of you vote, you count the votes, you can audit the votes, which was done. You can appeal in court if you disagree with certain ways in which the election was carried out, which was done. Multiple efforts by the Trump administration or the Trump campaign to try to prove that somehow there was fraud and he should have won. He lost all of those cases. None of the audits showed systemic fraud or significant changes in vote count. And here we find ourselves on January 6th. And the answer for a sizable portion of the country, because a lot of people, even if they weren't there in person, agreed with what the insurrectionists tried to do. They believed that their violence was justified. They believed that because Donald Trump had lied to them. They believed that because a significant number of Republican elected officials went along with it. And that's where we get to the Republican Accountability Project. On the other side of January 6th, we watched as leaders initially condemned what happened on January 6th, because remember, they were on the receiving end of it. They were frightened for their lives. The mob was very unruly. They weren't sure what the intent was. There were people there that clearly had come prepared to potentially carry out acts of violence. So they were right to be scared. And so initially, they came out and they condemned it, and they condemned Donald Trump and his incitement of the violence. It was irresponsible. And then they started backtracking. And we had a conversation, my colleagues at the Republican Accountability Project, Sarah Longwell, Bill Kristol, Olivia Troy, and we said, this cannot stand, because if we wait like 6 weeks, there was already talk of impeachment proceedings, but we knew that it was unlikely he was to be impeached. You get it to the other side of that, and they start doing what we all expect them to do in the normal course of governing a COVID relief bill. There was, you know, an agenda of infrastructure. Those are all important things. We want the government to do that work. But you could see that they were laying the groundwork to just pretend that January 6th never happened. And in our minds, that was just such a deep, dangerous point that we had gotten to, where really never in American history, short of the Civil War itself, have we seen Americans decide to take up arms against their own government in a almost a manner to violently overturn the will of the people. And anybody that encouraged it, that incited it, and anybody that defended it and didn't condemn it and hasn't consistently condemned it needs to be held accountable. So that's where the Republican Accountability Project came. We knew that people would try to forget or try to whitewash history, and we wanted to make sure that as we approach 2022, the best way to hold people accountable is by voting for the people that had the integrity to say the right thing, to tell the truth to the American people. It's a relatively small number of individuals that are in that category from the Republican Party. And then we want to hold accountable those officials, and there's a lot of them in the Republican Party, that continue to perpetuate the big lie, that voted to overturn the election, and that continue to support Donald Trump through his many antics trying to sow this lie of a stolen election. That's how we came up with the project, and it's something that we have committed over $50 million to try to basically campaign against those that were the most egregious in undermining our democracy.
We'll have more about the goals and actions of the Republican Accountability Project and the threat of domestic terrorism in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Elizabeth Newman, co-director of the Republican Accountability Project, formerly senior advisor and deputy chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security and assistant secretary for counterterrorism and threat prevention. I'm Carol Castiel, along with assistant current affairs producer Ian Kelly. He's also a student at the University of Wisconsin. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Nelson Azuma from Tema, Ghana. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, now I'd like to turn to my colleague Ian Kelly, Elizabeth, to pose some follow-up questions to you. Ian.
Now, Elizabeth, even after the attack on the U.S. Capitol, numerous Republicans in Congress still voted to not certify the Electoral College. And then you have states like Georgia that passed laws making it harder to vote. Laws that many have criticized as Jim Crow 2.0. How has this emboldened the domestic terrorists who attacked the Capitol? And do they feel partially successful even though the insurrection failed?
That's a great question, Ian. So let's start with how does it embolden domestic extremists? What happened on January 6th, and this is coming from researchers that have been looking at the data of those that have been indicted so far, because that's the best set of facts that we can glean is those court records of people being indicted. Several groups are studying this. In particular, I'm referencing a University of Chicago study that found that only about 13% of the people indicted were affiliated with violent extremist organization. The rest are what we would consider unaffiliated. One of their findings is that January 6th represents a shift in the extremist threat. So the threats that I was warning about last year during the election, the things that we were concerned about, what we saw manifest in El Paso, for example, or Christchurch earlier that year, March 2019, Christchurch, New Zealand, that threat is still very real. Parts of the world call it right-wing violent extremism. The United States calls it racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism, also anti-government extremism. So very specifically two subcategories, white supremacist violent extremism and anti-government militia violent extremism. That threat exists, and January 6th was a rallying cry moment for those movements. Those movements tend to believe that there is a coming civil war. Some believe it's a racial civil war, but the whole idea is that we will see societal collapse, the U.S. government will fail, and that they will be able to reestablish a government. Now, if you're a white supremacist, you're looking to establish an entirely new country, a white nation state. If you're an anti-government extremist, you might not necessarily be racially motivated. It might just be you want to go to a new government, kind of returning to what they believe are the founding principles of very limited federal government. So there are places where their ideologies certainly diverge. There's a lot of overlap. And the commonality is that they're both seeking this violent overthrow of the U.S. government. So those have been seen by the law enforcement community, the security community, as particularly dangerous because of that desire for violence and overthrowing the U.S. government. That threat's going to persist. We had a Homeland Threat Assessment issued in October of last year, another one reissued in March of this year by the Director of National Intelligence, saying it's all but certain that we're likely to see more attacks from those threat actors. The separate category that the University of Chicago noted is new is this mass political violent movement. And that is very tied to Trump's lie about the election. And they estimate, they did a poll that estimated about 4% of Americans believe that the election was stolen and violence is justified. Now, a larger percentage believe that the election was stolen, but 4% believe election is stolen and violence is justified. That equates to about 10 million Americans. That is far beyond our law enforcement capacity to deal with, let alone figure out which of the 10 million that might pose a threat. So it's a very significant problem and not one that law enforcement is well suited to address because the underlying causes are inherently political. And you're seeing that challenge play out in the way that Congress is even handling how to investigate January 6th. There's a lot of whataboutism, there's a lot of pointing fingers, and it's almost untenable that the body that we need to pass a law to establish a commission to study what happened on January 6th and address root causes and all of the things that you would hope would happen after a major event like that, that body that has to pass that is the Congress itself, both the target or the victim of the attack, as well as part of their membership was responsible for causing the attack. So it's a very difficult circumstance to be able to even begin to remediate. And I hope that they do finally come to an agreement on a commission so that for the sake of our future and having a historical record of what went wrong and maybe some recommendations on how to avoid this in the future, I really think we need a commission. But I'm also not very optimistic about that. And I wanted to share that, Ian, to answer the part of your question about, you know, are they emboldened? Is the environment making their violence more likely? And the answer is yes, because we didn't see a change of behavior from those elected officials. We see them doubling down instead. We see them using January 6th as another political football to raise money off of and to sow grievance. A lot of the playbook, if you will, that is creating the grievance is this idea that they, whoever they is, people that are different than you, are trying to marginalize you. They're trying to humiliate you. They're trying to take away something from you. Now, these are common causes for why people are motivated towards extremism. Like if you look under the veneer of ideology, what actually drives somebody to be radicalized and commit violence in the name of that radicalized belief tends to be other psychological factors associated with a sense of humiliation or loss of significance or loss of power. And we just spent an entire campaign cycle, arguably the entirety of the Trump administration, telling half of the country that the other half of the country is trying to marginalize you and humiliate you and cancel you. And so we've ended up with a lot of grievance sowing that when you're doing it on such a large scale of tens of millions of people being told this, it's not surprising that a handful, small percentage, believe that violence is justified. It's almost a mass radicalization exercise that Trump was able to perpetuate. You bring in the false story of the election being stolen, and they were primed to believe that this is an existential threat. And it's not illogical that they get to the conclusion that violence is justified, given what they've been told to believe.
Elizabeth, based on what you just said, we're seeing that it's going to be very hard to, as we say, you know, put the genie back into the bottle, even though President Trump wasn't responsible for the fact that we have in this country white supremacist groups, we have had for decades anti-government militia groups, but he certainly incited them on that day. And before that, he pushed the lie. So how are we going to stop this, especially when you have empirical evidence that points to these white supremacist domestic terrorist groups? And many Republicans cling to the idea that somehow it was the so-called Antifa, this amorphous anti-fascist alliance, that was actually behind the insurrection, playing down the real documented threat from these white supremacist anti-government militia groups.
So I'll answer that question a couple of ways. From a government perspective, when you look at the big picture, the best answer would be if the elected Republicans that were Trump supporters would come out and tell the truth. That would have a de-radicalization effect. Now, it wouldn't solve the entirety of the crisis, but it would shrink the pool that we had to be concerned about. Here we are 100 plus days after January 6th, and while a handful have done that pretty consistently, most are not doing that, or they're avoiding the topic altogether. So I'm not entirely hopeful that we are going to see Republican officials help us with this cause. Nonetheless, I still think we hold them accountable, and that's why I do the Republican Accountability Project. The second thing that could have helped at a mass level would be if some of the conservative news outlets had done a better job beyond the statements that they read when they got sued, clearly explaining why the election was not stolen. Now, it helped. There were some lawsuits at the beginning of the year by the people that own the voting machines, and they sued a number of these news outlets because their names had been defamed as causing election fraud. And it turned out that that worked. It forced a number of news anchors to have to read statements on the air. And anytime somebody started to claim something about one of those voting systems, the anchor would have to cut in and say, we have no evidence of this. So that lawsuit actually did help some. There is some evidence that it helped change the mind of some Republicans. So that's helpful, but probably not enough. And we would have needed the Fox News, the OAN, the Newsmax, and the other conservative radio talk show hosts that a lot of Republicans listen to. We really would have needed them to do something much more significant to do that mass level of change. So if we're not going to do it at the mass level, then that leads me to, okay, we have to do it at a grassroots level. It's going to take a lot longer, and it's much more challenging because you're up against these mass systems, elected officials and media that, you know, are somewhat at least tolerant of the big lie and at times complicit in pushing it. So this is by no means an easy effort, but I will say that when you study radicalization and extremism and and you look at why people move away from it, it does tend to be not because of some mass effort, somebody on TV telling you not to do something. It does tend to be because of personal relationships. Because again, the thing that is often driving somebody towards extremism tends to be psychological factors, not necessarily ideology. So addressing those unmet needs tends to happen one-on-one or in small groups. So grassroots movements, and there are several groups that are out there trying to work at this. It's going to take a long time, though. I think we're in for a generational struggle here of violent extremism, and we'll have some very sad days ahead of us as we deal with the manifestations of the violence.
Yes, a generational struggle with regard to domestic extremism and trying to rid the landscape of some of these right-wing echo chambers that push these falsehoods, which you just mentioned. That's a serious challenge. And some analysts are saying that some of these networks like OAN or Newsmax are actually a danger to democracy and should not even be treated as press. But let me turn to Ian Kelly, who may have another question for you.
Thanks, Carol. So, Elizabeth, there's been a lot of discussion about the domestic impacts of the attack on the U.S. Capitol, but there's many international impacts as well. You have adversaries like Russia and Iran, who are no doubt delighted to watch the attack unfold. But the U.S. also seems to have lost a lot of its credibility abroad in terms of promoting democracy. We often lecture other countries on the peaceful transition to power, but had its own capital attacked during a transition to power. Now that it's been several months since the failed insurrection, what are the impacts abroad?
That's a great point, Ian. So in the counterterrorism community, we have heard from our partners overseas for a couple of years now that they are frustrated with the United States' lack of action on what they call right-wing violent extremism. And part of that lack of action is because of the way our laws are framed. So we have a lot of laws that are written about foreign terrorism, but those laws restrict us from being able to do things related to domestic terrorist groups. So one of the policy debates that I would hope a commission would look at is whether we need to change some of those laws. It's very complex. Civil liberties and First Amendment rights would need to be taken into account. Nevertheless, when we were the country that went around the world after 9/11 and invited allies to join us in the fight against terror, and at times cajoled and pressured people to join us in the fight against terror, for us to be one of the primary exporters of this latest iteration of terrorism, that is not a great place for us diplomatically. So I'm pleased that the Biden administration is taking domestic terrorism much more seriously and trying to figure out how we can be better partners in going after this threat. So you add to it what was happening on January 6th, and you're right, our credibility is shot for quite some time. It plays into our enemies' hands, who are going to use what happened on January 6th as a reason why a third country shouldn't trust us, that we are a bunch of hypocrites and we don't actually practice what we preach. And you brought up Russia and Iran. Russia intelligence community has been very clear in its public statements that Russia's aim is to sow societal discord in the United States so that we are so weakened that we cannot counter them in whatever their strategic aims might be. We can't possibly talk with substance and nuance and distinctions because everything turns into high-level talking points. And there are multiple instances. It's not just January 6th, right? There's a whole conversation we're having as a nation around police reform and around systemic racial injustice and how do we address that. And you have one side saying there is no problem and the other side saying there's a really big problem and we can't even seem to come to agreement on the terms. An adversary like Russia or Iran are delighted that we are in the place that we're in. It helps them with their strategic aims. And then they're continuing to use some of their tools to amplify and spread disinformation to further that societal discord.
Elizabeth Newman is co-director of the Republican Accountability Project, previously a senior official in the Department of Homeland Security. Elizabeth, thanks so much for a fascinating conversation about the threat of domestic terrorism. Greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Carol. It's quite a privilege to join Voice of America and your program.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was assistant producer Ian Kelly. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.